Mayo, I gotta get this off my chest. I upgraded the iPad Pro from 11 inches to 12.9 inches. And
so you've already had three iPad Pros in total in the last month. So you're almost on one new iPad a week at the moment.
Yeah, this is absolutely the end of this saga. but it's the same theme, which is I'm getting more use out of it than I thought, and I want to do more with it. Now I don't want to do anything more than what I'm doing now. So we're at the end here. But just for the final tally, it is 12.9 inch iPad Pro, 256 LTE. That's it.
So you don't expect to need to do any more of 750 gigabytes worth of upgrades?
No. Or any more RAM, all the things you can add.
I know everyone's like, oh, the big one, 6 gigs of RAM. I do think buying that this year, expecting stuff to change, is very premature. Like, I would not, if you're still on the fence about buying a new iPad Pro, I would not worry about the 6 gigs of RAM thing and just get, like, if you want to use 1 terabyte of storage, then sure, obviously pay the massive premium, but I would not go that high up just for something that theoretically might apply, you know, probably not even next year, maybe like a few years down the road.
People who are buying six gigabytes of RAM or 1 terabyte for the RAM will also buy the new version when something takes advantage of that. You know what I mean? Like when iOS 13 is out.
And yeah, it'll be like, next year I'll just resell my iPad and get the 2019 one anyway. It's like, yeah. And I don't think resale value would be any less proportionate to the price you paid originally. I don't think it'll be like, oh, now just because you got the highest out middle, you're actually getting more money back on it. I think
the people who will appreciate 6 gigabytes of RAM will also want the newest one too.
They won't be buying used as well.
It's very niche. The influencing thing there was our colleague Michael Stieber kind of influenced me when I showed him the workaround to have Twitter and a timeline column streaming in real time through Chrome as the slide over app that floats above your two split screen apps. He was like, that's the first time I've wanted the iPad to be bigger. And that like planted a seed in my head, which was, I like this iPad Pro so much and like, it's really good. And I just want that's the one that I want. And so, made the exchange and everything. And it was gradual, but it's like, okay, I started out with the base one, and then I realized I wanted more storage. I wanted cellular, and then I wanted the big one. And it was nice to experience both of them. But I am locked in now at the big one.
Yeah, the big one is really nice. And I was encouraging you before you got it to get the 12.9, because I just know how much nicer it is just to browse the web on a big screen. It feels so much cooler.
Positive though that if I would have went big first, I would have returned it and ended up with a small one, because I would have been unsure about it. But working my way up was nice. A few things I've been meaning to mention about how I'm using the iPad Pro. One thing is as a teleprompter for the 9 to 5 Mac Daily podcast, where I kind of write the script ahead of time, and then, you know, it's just me, so I'm not good at just talking with myself, you know? Like, I'm fine with talking to you, but not with myself as well, even with, like, bullet points. So I tend to, like, write the script out. In the beginning, that was very rough, and I think I've gotten pretty good at it since, like, the first dozen episodes. But what I found to be super helpful and, like, really neat is loaded up into the iPad, and there's a teleprompter app. I'll look up the name of it in a moment. But, you know, what I do with that app is I just read the script, and it moves along based on what I'm saying, so like speech recognition matched to what the script is, and that's really neat. And in the first day, I had no iPad when I was like in one was returned and like one was on the way. I just like instinctively went to like load up the iPad with a script and read from it, and I was like, oh, I don't have it. I got to go back to scrolling a text document, and it was just like way worse. So
I didn't realize this existed. So You like write the script on the iPad, I assume.
I write on the Mac. I write it in ByWord on the Mac, just as like a text file.
Okay, and then you like copy it to the iPad or whatever, and open it up.
Then I've got ByWord on the iPad, and there's probably a way where I could like have it sync to the app that I'm using, which is called Prompt Smart, and it's Prompt Smart Lite, which is like the free one, and you only get like a couple of scripts at a time, or you can pay like $20 and it's like the full version, which I'll probably do just because I think it's a really really nice app. But then you can have like probably unlimited scripts, and maybe you can sync it better. But I open
and it listens along to what you're saying and moves the cursor of the teleprompter along with what you're talking. Like, that is actually really cool.
Yeah, like the text is like centered, and as you read, and you can like take over if it gets, you know, a little bit off. But it's super natural and just kind of feels professional anyway.
Yeah, because the pages, the Apple app, which is free and included, is like the iWork suite, added a teleprompter earlier this year, I think. It wasn't too long ago, but there's... It's kind of funny that you have like this word processing app and then you have a teleprompter built into it. It's like a bit rant. You know, it's kind of off center, but it kind of makes sense when you think about Apple education maneuvers, in that they have like lesson plans and curriculum where they encourage the students to kind of make a mock script of like a news report or something and then perform it. And so it's a lot easier for them if they can just recommend using all their own free apps, which they know aren't going to disappear and aren't going to suddenly have weird pricing problems into them. Like, that's what they can distribute to the schools, like the iWork suite, which is always free. And then you get this teleprompter built into Pages, and you can just write out your words, and then you go like the settings button and a teleprompter, and you choose in Pages, you just choose a word per minute, basically, like a rate, like a speaking rate, and then it just scrolls, and it makes the text bigger, obviously, so you can see it from afar, and it just scrolls automatically. Whereas this is obviously a bit cleverer in that if you pause or whatnot, it can actually move along or speed up. In reality, what you'll find is after a couple of tries, you almost always talk at a consistent speed. Like, whatever your natural speaking rate is, you'll do that almost every single time when you're just talking to yourself and not talking to somebody else and you're just reading from a script. So if you're out there and you want something, like, I would definitely check out the free one in Pages, because Pages are great up anyway, and obviously it's free, might as well give it a go. But
yeah,
that thing is really cool. Like,
yeah, Prompt Smart Light is also free. Like, I don't think I've paid a dollar even yet. And like, the only reason you'd need to pay the $20 is if you wanted to have like multiple speeches saved in there at one time.
Yeah, I see.
And they show like a Prompt Smart Studio. Like, a Pro is the paid version, but there's like Studio coming soon, and I don't know the developers or anything about it. I just like found it through curiosity, you know, a few weeks ago, and apparently there's a Studio version coming, so maybe I should wait until that's available to see what the Pro and Studio differences are. But the day that I didn't have it, because my iPad wasn't here, I used my Mac and tried to find like an equivalent on the Mac, and there are lots of teleprompter apps on the Mac that you can try for free, but I couldn't find one easily that would match your voice, you know, like the movement with what you're saying. So it's really impressive. I recommend it if you have a reason to use something like that. Another thing I wanted to mention, it had a thought in my head this week that I wanted to share. Anyone who plays guitar probably has this experience where your fingers, it's very hard to reach frets on the guitar, like the long neck wood part, to make chords. And as you practice, like your fingers, it becomes easier with practice. And it made me think, that's what these big iPhones are like. And to an extent, like even like big iPad, because you've got to like, you know, get a feel for the device. It's like, it just made me think, with the gradual climb of the iPhones getting bigger and bigger each year, we kind of got adapted to like, you know, all of a sudden, like 3.5 inch to 4, 4 to 4.7, and 5.5, and then like where we are now, maybe think that's very much like learning to play guitar. Like your hands just stretch, and like, because I remember when the 4 inch phone was new, I used to get like hand cramps because it was just like different on my hand to hold. And now these phones are humongous, and the 4 inch phones are tiny.
The thing you can always think back to is that ad they did for the iPhone 5, whereas you hold the iPhone 5 in your hand and your thumb goes from here to here. It's like, and the iPhone goes from here to here. But
coincidence?
Obviously,
no.
It's just you know, empty words, really, because your hands adapt a lot more than what it seems like at the time. Because you know, the year before the iPhone 5 came out, everyone was like, my thumb goes from here to here, touching the 3.5 inch screen. And then, even as obviously nowadays the phones are so big that yes, you can exceed the physical limits of your anatomy. But
yep.
I think most people can accommodate like the 4.7 inch phone without problems. Like, maybe you think it's too big to be in your pocket or whatever, but there are very few people who physically can't touch all parts of that screen, I think.
Yep. So if you want to be better at guitar, buy the bigger phone is my point. Another thing is having the bigger iPad makes my iPhone XS Max feel a little less stupid. The Max and the 11 inch iPad Pro are like nowhere close to each other. Like, the iPad Mini isn't even close to it. But for some reason, like, that combination didn't feel good. But the difference, like, the 12.9 inch iPad is just, like, it's really big. Like, it's big. It feels bigger than a 13.3 inch MacBook, because I guess it's like closer to you in most cases. And like, you know, you're closer to it. So it's, yeah, just, it's just different. But for like, I no longer feel annoyed about the Mac. Like, I still wanted to do more things. Like, I was taking a picture over the weekend and I wanted to take a panoramic picture. And I was annoyed that I had to slide past the square camera. That's really stupid to take a pano when I have got the biggest iPhone they make and they could fit all the little labels as, you know, tap them without having to go to the square camera first to reach it.
Yeah, and I mean, you shared a screenshot of your camera app on the Max with me, and I sent back a picture of the camera app on the 5.8-inch iPhone X, or obviously XS, the same resolution. And in terms of the buttons available for you to press, it was identical. Like, you could see, you know, maybe 10 pixels of the next word of the slider, and that was it. And it's like how the screen's so much bigger, but you can barely do anything different with the app.
Yeah,
the camera app is a particularly bad offender, but it's... Mm-hmm. It's going back to what we were talking about last week, how the iOS experience is built around this, you know, 4.7-inch phone style class still, and the Max is just kind of inflate stuff rather than providing more content. And I was actually going to ask you, do you now see that on the 12.9-inch now? Like, because obviously there's more spaces where it's just blank, empty margins.
Totally. Yeah. Like, the 12.9-inch iPad is I like to read the web in portrait. Sometimes, like, just that's the full page of Safari, and like I'm reading a website, you know, an article or something. That feels really nice. But a lot of things in portrait just feel silly, and so, you know, landscape is more natural. The camera should be in the center at some point because it's awkward on the side. But yeah, totally. Like the bigger iPad just feels like you need to multitask, and that's the kind of thing. Is like, if you're thinking 11 or 12.9, if you use more if you use multiple apps on the screen at one time, then the bigger iPad might be for you. If you're okay with one, like this smaller iPad is still called Pro, but there are things about the bigger one that it can do, like have, you know, we mentioned last week, multiple panes in the mail app, which isn't just seeing like your different mailboxes, but then you've got the ability to drag multiple, like tap multiple messages in mail and then drag them to a mailbox. Like on the 11-inch iPad, you've got to do that and then like do a swipe gesture to like reveal the mailboxes, and it's not intuitive at all. Like those feel more like pro-worthy in the name and just how the apps are laid out, but those are also rare instances of how the screen real estate's being used.
Yeah, because just if you're on the 12.9, you end up living in if you're living in landscape, because that's kind of the default now, the like implicit default for a lot of things, and you're essentially then living and multitasking, because to make the app feel well proportioned, you almost want a skinny column always to not have something so wide that it just feels ridiculous. And obviously on the 12.9-inch, you also get the big benefit of the two apps, if you do a 50-50 split, can be they're the regular size class, so they actually are iPad design layouts in that mm-hmm. in that split view orientation. Whereas if you do split view on the 11-inch or 10.5, they revert back to compact size class, which means you get kind of iPhone layouts and like the you see less buttons and stuff at the same time. So yeah, the 12.9-inch feels a lot better for that use case. So a very rough guide of, you know, you want to do multitasking, get the big one, you don't, then get the small one, is a very good like barometer for that.
Yeah, definitely. I would totally love it if you could do three apps at one time. Like not three apps with two on the bottom layer and then one floating that can move around, but like three stacked. Because a lot of times when I'm doing the slide over app, I've got it over like half of a Safari, which is like 2/3 of the screen, and then Slack as 1/3 of the screen. And it's like, if I could make Safari a third as well, like TweetDeck and Chrome could be a third, Slack could be a third, and Safari could be a third, and I could get a lot done like that. Like, that would be pretty cool, because right now I'm like Safari is half obstructed, but I can move the app out of the way pretty easily, but then, you know, Slack's obstructed. It's just like, if I could actually do three with no obstructions, like the website would just like, you know, resize, it'd be totally like, I'd love that. That'd be great.
Yeah, you'd have like three tall iPhones in a row, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that sentiment is exactly what I said when the 2015 iPad Pro came out and I was using it. I was like, don't worry, next year they'll add a third column for another app, and nothing happened.
This week, 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Zugu Case. And together, we're giving 9to5 Mac Happy Hour listeners the chance to win Apple's brand new 12.9-inch iPad Pro. Zugu Case makes Amazon's highest-rated iPad case for previous models, And now the company is launching a brand new version for Apple's new iPad Pro called the Muse Case. Available for both the 11-inch and 12.9-inch models, the new Muse Case is a thin yet super protective case that also includes a built-in magnetic stand and even more improvements. The really great thing about the new Muse Case is that it actually allows Apple Pencil charging without having to cut a big hole in the case that exposes the iPad. Not only does this look better visually, but it can also prevent scratching the area around where the new magnetic Apple Pencil connects to the iPad Pro. So check out the giveaway entry on 9to5Mac.com to enter our 12.9-inch 2018 iPad Pro giveaway, and check out the new Muse Case from Zugu Case to support the show. Our thanks to Zugu Case for sponsoring 9to5Mac Happy Hour. And what's the cutoff for the slide over app? Like, if you're on an older iPad Pro, you can have two apps side by side and then slide one over and the background like freezes. You can still, it's like dull. You can't.
Yeah. So what this the 2017s and later do not participate in this. So it's the 2016 and the 2015 iPad Pros. If you have those models, like me, and you do a split view, two apps at once, and then try and pull over the slide over flowing app, the background will essentially be snapshotted and dimmed out, so like grayed out, and you, to interact with it, it pushes the flowing app away and then brings them back to life, because it makes it look like they're still on the screen, but really you're just seeing a screenshot of them and they're frozen. It's as if you've multitasked to another app, like entirely, you know, switched apps,
right?
But it just puts it on the screen so you don't lose all your context. But yeah, when you pull the side over, the backgrounds essentially disappear, even though they show you like the last state that they were in.
It's until like more for convenience.
So if you're playing a video on the background, It will freeze in that dim view. So it you can't interact with it and you can't see what's happening. So whereas on the newer ones, you can obviously, you're free to do it all. You can even interact with both the floating app and the background apps at the same time using two fingers. You can scroll both like together, which is kind of powerful in many ways, especially when you're doing like the drag and drop stuff. You can go boom, boom, rather than having to like boom, wait for it to slide off again and then do what you want with the dragged item.
And it's been... The rules have been broken in some betas, but it's never shipped this way. But like the cutoff there, so it's 2015 iPad, 2016 iPad, but then 2017 later it doesn't have the problem. And what Apple's looking at, the limit there is the amount of RAM, right? And what are the RAM differences? Do you know off the top of your head?
Doesn't my iPad Pro have 4 gigs of RAM though?
Oh, is that right? Oh.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure my 2015 is 4.
Mm-hmm. And the numbers this year are... 4. I was thinking 3 before, but right now it's 4, and then if you have the terabyte model, then it's 6. Is that right?
Yes. I really think mine 2015 is 4.
Yeah. What I'm trying to get to is, if anything, like maybe in the future, all 6 gigabyte iPads could do 3, and then there'll be that one exception of the terabyte iPad also. Like if you happen to use the old one still, you know, then you could. That's what I'm thinking. Is like, what's the amount of RAM per app that Apple's like wants you to have on screen be at?
All right, I just confirm my iPad does indeed have 4. So, I have the same amount of RAM as you, even though we're 3 years apart.
Check you out. Well, my Geekbench scores are higher,
a lot higher, and you have a million other features that even the March iPad did that mine doesn't, which still makes me very sad. The thing is, though, do you really think? And again, this is just like an open question. We don't know. I would doubt that next year they say they add a third column, but you need 6 gigs of RAM. Are they really going to say only the 1 terabyte 2018 iPads can do it? I think they'd be much more inclined to say only the 2019 iPads can do it. That all come with 6 gigs of RAM as standard.
And because, then people with 6 gigabytes would complain, but you know, oh well.
But that's because, Apple doesn't advertise the RAM specs. Like, as the average consumer, you're not supposed to know what the RAM is. Like, you cannot ask Apple. Apple will not tell you what the RAM is. You have to find it out indirectly. Even if it's so obvious, you can just do a Geekbench test and it will report it to you. But I would be absolutely aghast if they next year they were like, we have exclusive features for the 6 gigabyte RAM 2018 iPad Pro. I think that'd be really, really weird. They'll probably have exclusive features for all the 2018 iPad Pros. So all of this year's, and obviously the new ones that come out next year, but splitting by storage for a feature that's underlying based on RAM when they don't tell you what the RAM is, I think would be it would be like ridiculous. So I would absolutely am aghast if they did that.
Yeah, yeah. I can also see there not being new iPads next year. Like, even though we've got sort of have new iPads every year, it's not the same time every year. You could look at it more as like we had the, you know, ignore the big iPad Pro, the original big iPad Pro. Just say like we had a March iPad Pro 9.7 inch, and then the next year we had a June 10.5 inch iPad Pro, and then this year we had a October 11 inch iPad Pro. So just looking at the base, the smallest sizes, it's not every year, it's more like every year plus three months. Yeah, which would put us next year we could be, you know, into like January or February or back in March again. So it could actually be like 2020, not 2019.
Yeah, and even if you include, you excluded my original one, even if you include the release date of that, because if they announced it in September, but it came out in November, so mm-hmm. you don't have to add many, if you add 3 months on, you're getting close to the March event anyway for the right. 2016 model. So they do seem to have this like not exactly yearly cadence. And regardless of whether there are new models next year or not, I think it's likely that the next models will not be as drastic as these ones were.
Sure, like, yeah, definitely.
These were the big landmark update for a while, in the same way that the iPhone X was the big landmark update to the iPhone, I think.
We might even see the smaller Pro be the same size for the first time ever, because so far every smaller Pro has been a different size. 9.7 inch, 10.5 inch, 11 inch. And there's probably not anything else they can do with that size. Like, you know,
I think if they do anything, they'll introduce another form factor that's either an iPad Mini Pro, or they'll do an even bigger one, like a 15-inch Pro.
Mm-hmm.
That could, because then they could just spec bump the rest of the line and introduce a new screen size if they wanted to do that. Like,
yep.
It doesn't. Based on the amount of changes they did to the external design this year, it'd be very out of character for them to completely redo it just, you know, one cycle later.
Yep. A couple of things on Apple Pencil. I mentioned when I had the 11-inch that the pencil on the side was really close to the volume buttons on the side as well. And I guess at the time that like that wouldn't be the case on the bigger iPad Pro. Well, it's not. It's like this is the way it's like. This seems like, you know, so many things seem like they're designed for the smaller screens and software, but then like they kind of work themselves out on the bigger screens. This is something where it feels like it was designed this way for the bigger hardware, and on the smaller hardware, it's like. The compromise is it's really close to the volume buttons. Also, I got the pencil. I returned my original pencil and got the pencil engraved. You know, no price difference there. It's just a matter of like waiting for the one to come back.
And, Apple doesn't screw you on prices for everything. You can have free engraving.
Free engraving, indeed. And it just made me realize, like, one more thing about being left-handed. I'd already mentioned before that the pencil snapping to the right would be really convenient if you're right-handed, but like if you're left-handed, then you're just kind of like reaching across if you're holding it in portrait, which is less convenient if you're just like picking it up, putting it down quite often. Well, if you get it engraved, it's already true for like the Apple Pencil like logo there. But if you hold it in your right hand, looking at the text yourself, like because you appreciate your engraving, it's the correct way. But if you're left-handed and you look at the text, it's totally upside down. It's like, it's cute. It's upside down though. And if the person, like if you hold it backwards in your left hand and like someone sees you with it, then they see the engraving the legible way, like the Apple logo, the way that it like it's backwards to you, but it's the right way to the other person. So it works out in that regard. But if you just like have an engraving because you want to appreciate it yourself, and you're left-handed, it's going to be upside down whenever you see it, unless you just like hold it.
Well. Yeah, they need to add an option for that, like rotate engraving 100, like flip 180 degrees. So
yeah, the pencil like charging clip side thing is harder because you've also got the folio, which is like a book, yeah. And like books read the way that they read, and they, you know, it's the left side facing it, and you know, U.S. English is like the format that goes in. So that's harder to do, but like the engraving thing, I would have considered it the other way if I could. And also,
that's something where you can see why it happened, because none of their previous engravable products were like wearable in that way.
Sure, yeah.
Or held in that way.
Yeah, they weren't like orientation fixed.
Yeah, they were always just written on the back, so you just turn it over and see it. It wouldn't be left hand or right hand. It doesn't matter how the iPad is engraved. It doesn't matter which hand you hold it in.
Yeah, it just like as soon as I saw it, and I held it, I went to go use it, and I was reading it, I was like, oh, that's totally upside down, you know. And if I was right-handed, oop, it looks perfect now. And it was just, you know, the redemption there is that if someone sees it as you're writing with it, then it's very legible. But yeah, it's a small thing, but it's a left-handed thing.
I'm going to get a pencil that's engraved with "I'm left-handed" and hold it in my left hand, so everyone else can read and find out I am indeed left-handed. Except I'm not; I'm right-handed, so the joke wouldn't quite work.
Someone flipped the text upside down and said, "Use this." I don't think it would work, but it would be clever. And then also, my daughter has the sixth generation iPad, this year's 329 iPad. And I had an Apple Pencil that she's used, and she loves the Apple Pencil, but she never has the cap on it. And I've also never seen her charge it. I always charge it for her. And so now that the Logitech Crayon is available, for consumers, not just education, you know, channels, I was purchasing some things from the Apple Store anyway. And so I thought, I'm going to try that. And so I traded, you know, I gave her the crayon instead of the pencil, and she was excited because it was something new, and it was like orange and you know, not it was different, and it does the same thing as her pencil for the most part. What's the one thing is like shading or the pressure stuff. It doesn't do it. Does shading, but not the pressure stuff. So she was happy with that, and it's got the matte feel to it, and it's like flat. You know, it's flatter, so it feels different in your hand. But it's a huge benefit for kids because there's no cap to lose, like for her little brother to like, you know, eat and choke on. And like I said, I've never seen her charge it by sticking the pencil in the iPad like you're supposed to do. I just do it for her. But with the crayon, I just told her, like, take the little cap off the end and it doesn't come all the way off. It just like peels back. And then plug in the cable that you charge your iPad with, because she's really good at charging her iPad. So now she knows that if her crayon dies, charge it just like the iPad, and that's way more manageable for a kid, I think. So kudos to the crayon, and it also feels kind of like how the new Apple Pencil feels, how it's matte finish. The crayon is like aluminum, so it's got kind of a rough texture to it, like the for the most part it's aluminum. So I was really impressed by that. Like it's more expensive through the consumer channel than the education channel, but it's still cheaper than the Apple Pencil is, so kudos
especially the new Apple Pencil.
Yeah. So if you've got a family iPad and kids want to use an app like Paper to draw with, or even the Notes app, like the crayon is pretty good. The only thing is
it is not as elegant, it definitely answers the same kind of problems that they made with it, that they fixed with Apple Pencil 2, just in a cost effective, bigger, fatter way. Like you have a button to turn it on and off, so it doesn't run out of battery. Different way to charge it than the kind of semi awkward way that the original pencil did it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and then it's got the whole thing with, like, in classrooms, it does the radio pairing versus, like, plug it into pair, and you can do any sixth-generation iPad. That part doesn't really apply to her, but because, like, you know, once it's paired, but in general, like, as a parent, I'm happier with her having the crayon than the pencil, just because the cap can't get lost, and the charging method is, like, the same as her iPad. She knows where the cable is, she can plug it in, so.
And say if you had two kids, both with sixth-gen iPads, you could just have one, like, family crayon, and they wouldn't have to worry about repairing, unpairing it. You could just hand it around.
Yeah, just imagine. two iPads is one thing, but like one crayon, you might as well get another crayon, because that's just picture how that goes.
fair.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, kids' hands are really dirty, and I just like in taking back the old pencil, I'll probably, you know, gift to somebody or sell it or something. It felt matte already, because like kids get stuff so dirty. It's just like it had like a layer of kid on it. No, it felt just like the new Apple Pencil has matte finish. It was not slippery at all. It was gross. The only thing about this, though, is that there are kind of like keyboard cases for the sixth generation iPad that have a pencil holder, but there's only one with a crayon holder that I can find, and that's the Logitech like Rugged Case 2 or something like that. And it's, even though the crayon is consumer channel now, unlike, you know, before it was education only, that case is still education only from what I can tell. And it's not pretty. It's the one that's got like
it's a super boxy.
Yeah, super boxy. It's got a lightning pass through. So I guess there's no Bluetooth involved. Like, it's kind of good. And she's kindergarten age. And I kind of think like this iPad right now that we use for like apps to learn to tell time and you know, flashcard apps and stuff like that, and some different learning games and then drawing apps like Paper. I think that it will last like, you know, just like I was a kid in elementary school with an HP PC tower to, like, you know, learn technology at home with, she'll have this iPad as, like, that for her. And I think it'll last for, like, several years as, like, her at-home computer that she's exposed to on her own. And I wouldn't mind, like, having a keyboard case like the one that Logitech sells to the Education Channel with the crayon holder, like, as, like, her full solution. But you can't buy it as a consumer unless you, like, know someone with the Education Channel access. So hopefully – I don't know if there's any other options out there available, but I'm kind of looking. But I hope that they kind of come about. So, but anyway, I was really impressed with the crayon. It's really nice. So, kind of recommend that. 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Ops Genie, now from Atlassian. Downtime is awful. You've lived through it. I've lived through it, and it's no fun. It doesn't matter if it's at home or at work or wherever you experience downtime. When a system you rely on goes down, it immediately throws a wrench in every part of your life. When it's worse is when you're the one responsible for fixing it, and you don't have a plan to manage your way through it. That's what Ops Genie is for. Ops Genie gives your team the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues. Are any bad issues ever planned for? I think we all know how that goes. Ops Genie helps you notify the right people through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths that take into account things like time zones, vacations, and holidays. Obviously, you want the right person notified immediately, but if that person is not available, you want the next person notified without having to wait only to realize that the first call person isn't actually on call. This is where Ops Genie's smart magic comes into play. It knows because you've told it previously. Back when times were calmer and you could think through it all, Ops Genie keeps track of all that for you, and when problems inevitably occur, Ops Genie is there to help. Also, now that Ops Genie is part of Atlassian, it opens to all kinds of integrations with things like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. That's what Atlassian is all about. They integrate well with their own solutions, but they also integrate with other popular solutions too. Check it out, opsgenie.com, to sign up for a free company account for up to 5 users, no credit card required, no time restrictions. This is a fully free account for you to actually use, not just try. That's opsgenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with Ops Genie. Our thanks to Ops Genie by Atlassian for sponsoring the show. All right, Mio, the Apple's in the kind of mentioned in the Supreme Court this week and in a case against it. Tell me what's going on with Apple and the Supreme Court and monopoly.
Yeah, this is all legal cases get so complicated and dressed up in the weeds. This is a case that was originally brought about in 2011 and rejected for not having an audience of people that are affected, because they're trying to allege that the prices in the App Store are inflated because Apple is the only provider of iPhone apps and levies the 30% fee. But to actually bring a class action lawsuit around, you have to show damages, which means you have to prove that prices are inflated. Now, obviously, at the very basic level, that sounds pretty simple. Like, oh, obviously everything's 30% more expensive than it could be. Not necessarily. It's very complicated. The legal case is kind of irrelevant. This ruling that's coming up at the moment in the Supreme Court isn't about whether or not prices were inflated and consumers were disappointed or affected by negatively impacted. It is just about whether the class action can sue Apple for the complaint, because there is an argument that they should instead be suing the individual app developers rather than Apple itself. And that is a completely separate argument about whether Apple is the customer, whether the developer is the customer, even though you pay Apple. Like, the recipient of the funds, is it an Apple business? Is it the company's business? It's incredibly complicated. What it did kind of alight to everyone in the industry, though, is a renewed discussion about Apple's control over the ecosystem and whether they should be allowed to hold such power and be the only provider of iPhone apps. Because obviously on Android, if you could dig into the settings menu, you can flick a switch that basically nobody does, but you can do it, that lets you download apps from any source. Obviously, they have the Google Play Store, which charges basically the same fees as Apple does, but is less limited. For instance, Spotify does not have to... Spotify can offer an alternative purchase mechanism. You do not have to use the Google in-app purchase system, whereas on the iPhone, you have to use Apple's in-app purchase system to sell digital products. So Spotify can either not be in the App Store at all, wouldn't require you just to log in the account, or they just inflate all their prices by 30% and pass it along. Because
the classic thing is, like, Amazon won't sell you a book through the Kindle app on iOS, right? Because then they have to share the revenue because it's a digital product.
Yeah, and they can, but obviously they then have to make the prices 30% more expensive to account for Apple's cut. Mm-hmm. Whereas on Android, they can just sell it and you just buy it straight through the Kindle store. My kind of view on this has changed a bit, mostly because of like the games console model argument, which is obviously if you buy an Xbox, Microsoft has a monopoly power over the games you can buy for the Xbox because you can't buy other games. And same with the PlayStation. Essentially, they control what is sold. And they also levy huge licensing fees on all the developers of those games to be available on the PlayStation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there is an argument of triviality because games consoles are not quite as essential to the world as a smartphone is anymore. The way I personally see this, and this kind of treads into like political arguments, but I have no clue where it would stand on the political spectrum. I think that Apple should be allowed to say that all software must come from through the App Store and be controlled by us. But they can't simultaneously charge unreasonable fees at the same time. And the problem, obviously, there's a lot of subjectivity in there about what is an unreasonable fee. Because is 30% unreasonable? Well, if you look in the old days or you look at traditional retail, like physical brick and mortar retail, 30% is pretty good because, you know, you buy something from a supermarket and they're getting 50% of straight off the top. Like the producers, the actual maker and manufacturers don't get that much. Whereas on the iPhone, you are getting 70% still, but you can also choose in the real world to not stock at that supermarket. You can stock at different supermarkets and they can compete on their pricing there. The problem for Apple is that they are the only supplier of apps, essentially. So they have no real disincentive to not charge 30% or even higher, right? Because they can charge 35 and no one's there to say, oh, we're charging 30, come use our store instead. So I kind of lean on the idea that they want to improve the user experience by locking the store down and not allowing apps that do random stuff. But they probably need some governmental oversight or law or legislation that stops them from, say, tomorrow, increasing App Store fees to 50%. And then, like, because you can argue about whether 30% is too much, but I think it's pretty clear to everybody that 70% is too much. And then, but at the moment, there's no oversight that stops Apple from charging 70% fees, apart from maybe some developers be upset, but they don't have a choice. The iPhone's instated, right? Like, they can't go anywhere.
Mm, yeah.
And I don't know what you think. Like, should Apple be allowed to... Do you think Apple should be forced to offer a switch that lets you install apps from outside the App Store, for instance?
So I guess the counter argument is like the market will decide what is fair, and if you went to 70, you know, then developers would look at the iOS business as not an opportunity anymore, and then iOS wouldn't have apps anymore, and then, you know, iOS wouldn't be an app platform anymore, and like that would be like the market taking, you know, reacting to Apple's like bad move. And so you don't have to have a regularly saying you can have a 70% cut of the 100%, you know, pie. You don't need a regular to say that. The market will take care of that for you. And that 30%, clearly the market is okay with that, whereas a more extreme number, they wouldn't be. And like where is that, you know, cut off? Probably like 40 or 50, like Apple's probably like at what they can handle. And if it was regulated, it would probably vary by country and it would be very messy. And maybe there would be a situation where if you change your region settings, then you can have a switch. And this already happens in iOS in lots of different ways. But based on region, maybe you could have outside apps because Apple's forced to do that.
Yeah, but maybe the EU rules that customers have control over their devices and they should be able to install whatever they want. So if you're in the EU, you get a Switch to install whatever, whereas in the US, it's more locked down, for instance.
Yeah, and there's examples of this for, like, I think in the EU, the volume indicator is different, like the way that it maxes out.
It tells you when your volume's getting really loud. It puts, like, red dots on the screen and stuff.
Okay, and then one Asian country, I think it's Japan, the camera app always makes a shutter sound, even if the phone's muted.
Yeah.
Because of a law that tries to prevent people from sneaking, it's really sad, but like upskirt shots of people.
Yeah.
Like sneaking photography without them knowing, basically, was a problem. So, you literally cannot mute the sound of the shutter button for that reason.
And that feature, or if you want to call it a feature or behavior, does not based on software region. That's based on the hardware. So if you buy model of the phone, you could, and then you move to another country, you can never mute that noise.
Right. So
whereas some other bits, for instance, the upcoming ECG app is going to be software region based, not hardware.
Yeah. Device so based. It's fully possible that it could be vary by region. And in that case, for the consumer, having the ability probably for more technical people, you'd want to you check that box and try and sideload apps. I mean, that's what we're talking about, is sideloading apps that are not from the App Store. And there'd be this whole complicated reason for why we got the button, but people would, people that are more techie would want the button.
It'd be the same percentage of people that jailbreak their phone back in the day. Which was not a dominating percentage. It might have been 1%, but and there's still millions of people, but it's not, the majority by any means.
Yeah. I mean, just thinking about it, I guess as the question is posed, I would I'm not super informed on the case at hand, but just
of irrelevant, the legal standing doesn't matter for what we're discussing.
Right. But I guess the question is, my answer would be probably that you wouldn't want to regulate this unless you're trying to correct something that is just a really bad behavior in the first place. Like, preventative regulation in this case sounds unnecessary. But in this case, someone is arguing that the way that it is now is too far already. And so then it's you're already weighing that question of how much is too much, how much is too far. So it's tricky, and that's where it's all subjective. It's what is the line? And then the fallback.
Because ultimately, if you don't like Apple's policy as a customer, you can go and buy an Android phone.
And in this case,
and that's where the lines of monopoly are really hard to define. Are you defining a monopoly over the iPhone store, or you're defining a monopoly over smartphone apps? It's a very different, scale of where Apple's influence lies.
Yeah, it's if Android didn't exist and wasn't so successful, it would be much easier to argue about, that Apple's got a monopoly here. But you don't really need a second app store on iOS to have competition, because you've got this massive operating system in Android that is also competition.
And the thing about the 30% fees, which is where it's kind of hard to argue that it's too high, is that the Google Play Store does give you the freedom, and in their marketplace, the Google official store still charges 30%. So the argument that, if apps were siloed, Apple would have to bring their fees down, doesn't really show merit on the Android side, because Google matches Apple's fees and no one seems to care, and it seems like most people just buy through the Google Play Store anyway. So it's the 30% number probably might not even be the strongest argument to try and break down the App Store control. There's probably easier arguments you can make about price fixing, in that you can't sell an app for less than 99 cents in the US, for instance. Yeah. Why can't you sell a 50 cent app? Mm-hmm. Which is funny, because in the UK, there's actually alternative price tiers where you can sell an app for 49p or 99p, but in America, there isn't. Or you could probably have a better case by arguing about some kind of censorship line about the App Store rules, about what's allowed in the App Store at all. Not just what price Apple levies on as fees, but literally what is allowed to be in the store and what is not. And a great example of this is the Steam Valve Link app that everyone had a massive fiasco and fury about a year ago. And the app where you could stream games from your desktop to your phone, and Apple rejected it for reasons that are in their guidelines. But are those guidelines, legally allowed to be enforced or not? This is going to be something that is not going to go away And obviously these cases take forever because this case originates from 2011 and this is only just the very, very first step of it ever going anywhere like further. So, and it probably will get appealed and appealed and appealed. So it's going to take decades to sort of stuff out. But all of these arguments are reasons why I can see like maybe more regulation or rulings will come into effect. It's a tough one. And what really like came into my head about this, I think Apple should be allowed to give the control over the store, but maybe not necessarily impose ridiculously high pricing, is kind of a weird corollary in the hardware repairs place. And this is another ongoing argument about whether you should be allowed to repair your own devices. And obviously, Apple loves to lock down the repair component supply chain as well. And it's hard for people to do third-party repairs on anything nowadays in the light of things like Secure Enclave and T2, or just finding the parts. And there's a lot of counter arguments and stuff and legal stuff that's going rumbling around about right to repair rules and stuff like that. And only this week, I actually sent off my mum's phone to get a battery replacement. And the battery replacements at the moment are what I would consider reasonably priced, right? In the $30, $25 range, because obviously the throttling fiasco, which is ending at the end of this year. So if you want a battery replacement, you can get it, you know, cut price for only about another month. But, and that to me feels reasonable for like the cost of labor to get the thing swapped out and the device and the actual component. But what if the battery replacement cost $100 or $200? Like then it would feel, you know, punitive and prohibitive. But again, you know, Apple almost has a monopoly over the repair market. So it's like, and this is like another example of effectively the same thing. It's just about, you know, the physical hardware, not software. And I would probably believe that Apple should be allowed to control the repair ecosystem, but under the proviso that they can't charge ridiculous prices to have repairs take place. And so, because I think there are good reasons why you want to, you know, only have things repaired at authorized resellers and authorized repair centers rather than just letting people put, you know, random different components in their phones. But at the same time, I wouldn't want to be in a position where, you know, Apple's charging people hundreds of dollars for any type of repair that happens. So there are a lot of different levers here. It's hard to come down on something like definitive.
Yeah, adjusting like my let the market do its work idea. If Apple was made to have to allow apps to be sideloaded, competing apps on iOS, you could still argue that the market would work it out, because on Android, like how popular is the Amazon App Store compared to the Google Play Store? And there's like
not very.
There are so few instances of like major apps not being in the Play Store. Like what was the game Fortnite? Yeah, and it's like that's a major exception. But for the
they explicitly made their own launcher and downloader because they don't want to give Google 30% of their cut.
Right.
And then on iOS they don't have a choice, so they give Apple 30% of the cut. So
right.
That's like one of the big high-profile examples of a brand that's probably strong enough to actually be outside the normal stores.
Mm-hmm. But it's a major exception, and so if on iOS Apple was made, they had to have competing app stores, then the markets could still decide, you know, figure out what is the best app store, and then you get into, you know, the built-in one has an advantage, but then I mean there's other differences like in quality of the apps and like features of the app stores and you know resources behind it. Like if you I imagine if you built in the Amazon App Store and the Google Play Store, like people would still lean toward the Google Play Store on their Google device. So I don't know.
And one other point here is that as Apple pushes further into its own services, the 30% premium problem becomes even more of an issue for it, like, because then you can say Apple's got a monopoly over, say, music streaming, because they don't have to charge themselves 30% of the income. Whereas
that's the Spotify versus Apple Music argument that Spotify always makes a fuss over, is that it, not only is it built in, but they don't have to give a cut.
and that's only going to get worse as Apple makes TV show subscriptions, book subscriptions, newspaper subscriptions. Like that's a harder argument where they themselves can just do what they want and everyone else is going to be at least 30% more expensive. So the direction Apple's heading in with its business does not make this an easier path for them in any way. Like even if their 30% cut gets dropped to 15%, that's going to hurt their services business, because a lot of services business is just App Store revenue. And it's definitely something that you shouldn't just like ignore, I think. Like is something to consider as the future of the company has a lot to do with this kind of, you know, like rent rating, you know, cut shares of revenue from other businesses, like indirectly. Like, that's a big part of Apple nowadays. That's just the reality.
This week, 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon is a premium essentials brand that believes in smart design and premium fabric. Pair that with a simple shopping experience, and Mack Weldon makes it super easy to shop online for quality clothes that you'll love wearing. Mack Weldon will be one of the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants, and more that you will ever wear. Mack Weldon is perfect for upping your gift-giving game, too, even if that gift is for yourself. They want you to be comfortable, so if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it, and they will still refund you. No questions asked, not even from us. Mack Weldon also has a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor, which is perfect for hot Novembers like today where I live, where it's 70 plus degrees with 80% humidity. I need all the help I can get. Not only does Mack Weldon's underwear, socks, and shirts look good, they perform well too. It's good for working out, going to work, and just everyday life. Personally, I've tried Mack Weldon's Seriously Soft Crew Neck Undershirt in Heather Gray, which I love for wearing around the house or even on a run, and Mack Weldon's Stratus Active Shorts in True Black, which are fantastically flexible and a great fit for workouts. The pockets on Stratus shorts zip up so you won't fling your iPhone to the ground when you sit down or lose your car keys on a jog, and their design is detailed, so they don't look like your average gym shorts. And my favorite part of Mack Weldon boxer briefs is the color variety. Weldon Blue is my top pick. Find your favorite color on MackWeldon.com, where you can easily shop by category, including underwear, undershirts, socks, tops and bottoms, accessories including caps and gloves, and much more. For 20% off your first order, visit MackWeldon.com and enter promo code HAPPYHOUR at checkout. Again, that's MackWeldon.com with promo code HAPPYHOUR at checkout to save 20% off your first order. Our thanks to Mack Weldon for sponsoring 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, Mayo, this past weekend, I didn't mention this on the show before, mostly out of like fear of completing it, but I ran my second half marathon. And
nice.
Yeah, if you recall, it was about a year ago. It was last December that I ran my first one. And this was like my running experience is not long. It started with the Apple Watch Series 2, which gained GPS, and so I wanted to try that out by doing outdoor workouts without the iPhone. And you know, you can take a walk, you can ride a bike, or you can run. There's not as much to do as like in a gym, for example, with different machines. But so I really picked it up and enjoyed it. And that was kind of like where I peaked, and then I took some time off. And this year though, I signed up, I trained much more ahead of time, and I had the experience of last year of what using the Apple Watch with LTE and AirPods was like on a run. And like I don't know, but the goal for the half marathon, like ultimately for me is like to beat 2 hours, and I'm not there yet. A year ago it was 2 hours and 27 minutes, and this year it was 2 hours and 18 minutes, which is a 9 minute improvement that I'm very proud of. But I still want to beat that 2 hour mark. But where it's relevant to like technology is that, you know, this year is the Apple Watch Series 4 versus Series 3, which has they rate it for 4 hours of outdoor battery life with an outdoor workout, with cellular, GPS, and streaming audio. And that's 1 hour more than the Series 3. And last year with AirPods and the watch, I struggled to finish the race with battery life on the devices. And this year it was no problem at all. But I changed from using AirPods to these Bose Soundfree Sport headphones that have no cable between them, but they're much bulkier than like AirPods in your ears. Like,
so last year, the Series 3 was rated for 3 hours, and this year it's 4 hours for the Series 4.
Yeah, easy to remember because it's 3 and 4. Yeah. Yeah, that's how I can recall off the top of my head.
But last year, your 2 hour and 20 minute time was not was still the watch died despite being rated for 3 hours. It already died.
It didn't die in 2.5 hours, but it was like I was in the red. You know what I mean? Like the last
10%. Right. Yeah, you were in trouble.
Yeah, you don't want to push it. Like that's the last thing you want to worry about as you're tracking your run. Like your you know, big accomplishment run is your watch dying and not recording it, you know, at the end. And then this year wasn't a problem. And part of it was like last year thinking about the AirPods dying, which was – they're rated for 5 hours at 50% volume. But at 100% volume, they're rated for 2.5 hours, you know, cuts it right in half. And, you know, and that's like up to – you don't always get that amount. Varies and so it was like really close. So this year I changed from AirPods to the Bose example, and they're in ear instead of like, you know, sitting on your ear, so the music's much louder without having the volume as high, and so that was really useful. And then with the watch, you know, I did a few things. I use an external heart rate monitor instead of the built-in heart rate monitor, and that saves you a lot of battery. And then I made sure that my music was loaded ahead of time versus streaming it entirely. And I still had cellular turned on, and I received a few messages, shared location for the whole race. You know, it wasn't like cellular was off. But if you really wanted to optimize, like for an even longer experience, you could turn off LTE entirely. But I really enjoyed it. I'm actually signing up for another half in 2 weeks. Actually, I guess it's a week from this coming Sunday, so that's coming up. I'm enjoying it. I'm comfortable with that distance now, and it's not worrying about battery life is a big win there.
So do you know roughly like how much percentage you finished on with the new one, with the new watch?
So we went from the race, me and my friend and his family that, you know, we were running with, and wouldn't have lunch after the race was over, and I had about 17% at the lunch table.
17?
So, yeah, 17. And that okay. was like way after the run was finished, and, you know, like the hours before the run started.
But you couldn't do a whole nother run again, right?
Oh, like, yeah, totally could not do
that. Yeah, because this is kind of – I'm kind of seeing – a full marathon as like the benchmark of where Apple probably wants to be.
Well,
able to push
and if you run a full marathon, some people can do it in 2.5 hours. They can go twice as far. So it's, you know,
yeah, but that's like, you know, average person is what, more like 4 hours, really. Like,
sure. Yeah,
you have to be pretty fit to do it in two. So
yeah.
I kind of feel like even the current best is still not quite there. And obviously you can do things like turn off heart rate monitoring and mm-hmm. use external monitors or not have cellular on, and that will prolong it, but you're still going to be tight just on, like, the workouts take a lot more active workout tracking, just uses a lot of power. And yeah, obviously it's a running watch, you know, Apple wants to use it as a running watch. And if you can't do a full marathon on the charge, I think that's, you know, not ideal, certainly. I bet that's on their list of things they want to be able to tick off, like, you can do a proper full marathon on this and be, yeah, be okay.
Yeah, they don't push it a lot. I've heard people that have finished full marathons with the watch, and I think, you know, not using LTE at all, not streaming any audio, even if it's local at all, and like we said, using an external heart monitor, those things go a long way, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And then also just being faster. But, you know, and another factor in all this is that my running friend, used my year-old Apple Watch Series 3, the one that I ran with last year. And his watch, like, it died before the finish line. And this is the same one. And his time was pretty good. It was 2 hours and 22 minutes. So it was fast. It was 5 minutes faster than mine last time, which my watch got me through. The same watch a year later died sooner, you know. And the factors are different software, watchOS 5 versus watchOS 4. And then also the wear and tear on a year of the Apple Watch being, you know, on all the time, basically. And that was tricky because, and actually, like a year ago, I did not use an external heart rate monitor at all, and he did. So that was another variable. And so it's like, you know, the best case scenario is it's a brand new battery. But like, once the battery has a year of wear on it, then you're really like, you want way more than enough battery than you can get through these long workouts. You don't want to be like right up against the limits of what's possible. So that was interesting. Just like, you know, seeing how these things last through the kind of these extreme situations and how you can optimize them. And I wrote a piece about the experience and, like, you know, the strategies for you know, like making the batteries get through the long races. And with the AirPods versus Bose thing, like, AirPods I use 99.5% of the time. But for these long runs, like, they're just not ideal. and they want Apple to make a version that is like in-ear, like they used to have in-ear wired headphones. I want those, but wireless. Like just having the same form factor, but in-ear with a little tip that goes like in your ear, makes the music louder at lower volumes. And that's, I hope like the, you know, AirPods 2 aren't just like an S update, but that they actually have some, you know, basically there's definitely room for like AirPods Pro, like AirPods Sport,
where they're, yeah, they're definitely AirPods in different form factors. Like they could even just offer like the same price and features, but you can have ones with wings, or you can have the little over ear ones like we have now.
Or even like you know, Beats has Power Beats and they have Beats X, and those are both wireless, but with a cord between each earphone. And it's like, and they've got the W1 chip for, you know, pairing. Fast pairing and, you know, pairing to your iCloud devices, but they're not truly wireless. And it's like, why hasn't Apple made them, like, even use the Beats brand to like sell a $250 pair of like basically AirPods, but
yeah, do Power Beats AirPod style,
right? Yeah, cut the cord like in between too. So
yeah
I don't know. And like Power Beats, they get 12 hours battery. They get a really good battery.
And the Bose, do they have auto pause stuff when you take them out of the ear or no?
Yeah, no.
Okay, so they're not as smart. Yeah.
But I'm keeping them, like a bottom of my own money and everything, like, and it was just like for the sake of testing them for this race. And they worked out, like they did the job. I never wanted the volume to be louder than what it, like I think I was happy with like 70 or 80% actually. And I didn't even like check the battery throughout the race because it just wasn't an issue. And I was really happy with how they performed. But then back to AirPods, like as long as I'm not doing something for that long. And then the other thing is that the watch, this really concerned me. With every mile of a half marathon is 13.1 miles. With every mile of the race, I would hit the 1 mile marker on my watch at about a tenth of a mile before the mile marker of the race. And by the end of the race, like that adds up, and it's like I finished a half marathon according to my watch, like before the last mile was finished
10% like, sooner than you should have.
Yeah, it's like that's discouraging. Like I want to stop running now. I've finished my goal, but then I've actually got to finish the race too. And it was like took a lot for me to keep going. And by the way, this race I felt great the whole time. I could have kept running, like I could have run further and felt good, like breathing still, you know, healthy and everything. Last time I like when it was over, I like laid down for like 10 minutes and just rested. And this time, like I was getting people drinks and everything, and it was just totally different.
10% error is quite a lot.
Well, yeah. And so I mentioned it in my piece that I wrote up, and you know, people on Twitter gave me some feedback. I didn't read the comments because comments are always like just brutal and stuff like that. And somebody like shared some with me, and they were just saying like, you know, focus on your runtime, not your technology. It's like, oh, thanks, buddy. I'm the tech site. you know, but
it doesn't matter. The AirPods can just say, it'd be 20%, 50% off. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just focus on yourself.
Right. Yeah, it concerned me. But then I got some feedback from people that have like the Garmin Forerunner 235 watches and stuff like that. They're just running watches is what they are. They're GPS watches. And they said, you know, people tell me that they get like sometimes they get better results, but sometimes they get the same type of error. And it's just like the variable can be you taking – corners different, like if you go sharper in than if you were to run further out, or you passing people, like if there's a big crowd and you run around them, then you extend your you know you're not running in a straight line, so then technically you do run further than like what they're marking the miles at.
Oh, I see. Yeah, like this is kind of the difference between taking a corner short and taking a corner wide, like you are running different distances.
Yep. And that's definitely a factor. I mean, I'm not like running in a straight line, like on a dotted line following it. And so that made me feel better about like what the watch is doing. It's still consistent enough that like I'm not sure that's entirely what's happening, but it made me feel like less like I need to go out and like spend $200 on a watch that I only use for like running and never anytime else, because I'm not going to wear like a running watch full time. Like I'm not that serious about it.
Yeah, and it probably depends on individual stride, GPS signal, that stuff is all conflating. Like I highly doubt that every single person that uses the Apple Watch Series 4 will have 10% error bars, for instance. Like it'll be very different
and I also feel like depending on. I would probably feel goofy if I was like the only person out there with an Apple Watch, but there were lots of people that like finished before me with Apple Watches, you know, like, you know, you see people with the Garmin stuff too, and like they're very serious, but then you see people like slower than you with Garmins and people faster than you with Apple Watches. So, you know, just use what you like. And I think all of it is like not perfect. The tricky thing is like the Nike Run Club app I mentioned often, it tracks your best performance per distance. So like my best marathon time or half marathon time last year had the same issue where it was like a faster time than what the race said it was. And all I can go by is like the photo finish. Same thing this year. It's like, I want to say my time was what it tracked, which was like 2 hours and 12 minutes, but it really like what the photo says was 2 hours and 18 minutes. And that's what I got to go by. That part kind of stings a little bit because I want to use the better number. but I'm not sure I can trust that number to give out. So, you know, the race is official at least. So I had a good time with that. And then another thing is, this is the last thing I'll mention this week, you know, a few weeks ago I was doing, sleep tracking with the old Apple Watch. Like mm-hmm. I had a Series 3. I did that for a while and, really enjoyed it. Like nothing about it bothered me. It was a bulletproof system of like take off my watch to charge, put on the other watch. And then, you know, I've got it in theater mode, do not disturb, mute, screen doesn't come on ever, you know, and the best thing about it was my alarm clock and it would silently tap me to wake up in the morning and it was perfect. But I saw someone, a friend from high school on Facebook, ask, should I get an Apple Watch? And that question like excites me so much because I love the Apple Watch and I love my experience of like getting into fitness stuff because of using the Apple Watch for unrelated reasons. And that experience like makes me happy, but I don't want to like evangelize about it and like try and sell people on something that they're not
starting a religion.
right. But down in the comments on this Facebook post, the person said, I kind of want to use it to get into running. And they also said, I don't want to spend much money. I'm thinking about getting the oldest, cheapest version. And I was thinking, that is painful. They're going to get a first gen, no GPS, slow as Christmas, can't run the latest software. Like, it's not going to be good. So I was looking up, like, refurb deals to recommend of, like, Series 2, 3, 4, you know, Series 2 or 3, you know, refurbished. And I couldn't find anything good. And I thought, you know what? I've got the Series 3 watch, and all I'm doing with it is sleep tracking. I don't need it. I can't sell it for any like amount that's worth the hassle of selling it to me. And this isn't like a stranger. It's a friend in high school. So I messaged and said, I've got an Apple Watch you can have for free if you want it. And, you know, and send it over, you know. I said, the running stuff, like, you know, it got me into this stuff. I went from like never exercising to doing a couple of half marathons. And the joy it brought me to like give – share that with somebody else for free. It was nice. And it made me think of Apple. This is really stupid, but it made me think of Apple's ad, Share Your Gifts. And I was like, like that made my day that day. It was yesterday. And I was just like, I'm so happy. And like, yeah, it was almost like too generous to be normal, like to share something like that for free. Yeah. But, you know, without kind of coming off creepy, but it's like, I wanted to do something with it.
Nice.
And yeah, and this morning I woke up without it for the first time. I had to use my Apple Watch as like the ring to wake me up alarm clock. And I was like, I miss that tap to wake alarm clock. That's really nice. but not enough to like, you know, have a second watch just for that. But if we can ever get to watch just like lasting through the night, because you actually had an experience yesterday where your watch lasted 2 days with two workouts and then you could charge it like every other night kind of thing. Yeah. I'm not there yet.
I mean, I don't have cellular and stuff, so there are mitigating factors.
You got a smaller battery though, too, smaller watch.
True. Yeah, I have 38mm and stuff.
Yeah, but anyway. So,
well, I will just say that you are a lot more altruistic than me, because just this week I sold my Series 3 watch for £200 on eBay, so I did not gift it to a random friend.
Yeah, well, wait till you get your eBay fee email and, you know, watch that tally. The total will go down a little bit.
Well, I'm not criticizing you for doing a good thing.
Yeah. Well, it's honestly, I'll tell you this. A lot of it is that I like the watch so much. And in the comments on this post, like people were – I was so happy to see that people that live around me have a similar experience for like different reasons. But I've also seen people like not get the watch or like think there's more to it than what there is, or think that like part of the experience is going to be like using apps, but then that's disappointing. And so, you know, it's disappointing. And then kind of get bored by it and just like wear it maybe or like not wear it. And so it's really tough for me to recommend even now, especially if it's not the latest, greatest watch. And especially if you don't want to pay a monthly fee for cellular. So it's one of the tricky things. Like I want to recommend it to more people, but it's you know, it's also a large cost and it can be an ongoing cost too with LTE.
Yeah, like the 279 Series 3 is better than the offering they've ever had at that price point before, but mm-hmm. it still needs to be cheaper. Like And I'm sure they'll go there, but it needs to get to like 200, like 199. It needs to be the previous gen model pricing, I think, for it to be like explosive.
And for me to recommend like my use case, it's go buy the latest watch, pay monthly for LTE, and pay a subscription music fee for Apple Music, and buy wireless AirPods. You know, like it's not cheap.
Nope.
So
100% is not cheap.
Yep. Anyway, share your gifts. Last week I was kind of I didn't get the ad as much, and this week I can.
You lived it.
It's a little bit different of a meaning, but it felt.
I didn't
felt nice.
Just watch the ad. I lived it.
All right, that's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can give us feedback at happyhour@95mac.com. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Apollo Zach Benjamin. You are
BZA Mayo.
And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.